93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
Because I felt like this record was sort of maybe a little bit of a rising from the ashes from Home Like No Place Is There.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. Before we get to today's episode, I just want to tell you a little bit about something that's coming up in May that I'm really excited about, and that's the release of my first book. It's called Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me, and it's a book of essays about famous music rivalries. So I'm talking about Beatles versus Stones, Biggie versus Tupac, Oasis versus Blur, and all the way down the line. If you like this podcast, I think you'll like the book. I'm really proud of it. I worked hard on it, and it's a great mix of, funny stuff and serious stuff, and I talk a lot about rivalries, but the rivalry talk is sort of a starting point to talk about a lot of other things. Things in the world ranging from politics to religion to death to all sorts of fun stuff. So if you like this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could check out my book. Again, it's called Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me. It comes out May 17th, and I think I'm ready now to start today's episode. Now, before we get to this episode, I need to warn you ahead of time. I gush a lot over the next hour. See, gushing is this thing I tend to do when I'm talking about records that I'm excited about. And today's episode is a regular gushapalooza, because I'm talking about two of my very favorite albums of the year, Teens of Denial by Car Seat Headrest and Goodness by The Hotel Year. Now, neither of these albums are out yet. They both drop in May. But my hope is that this episode will help prime the palate for two truly excellent rock records. First, The Hotel Year, formed in Massachusetts back in 2009 and released its debut, It Never Goes Out, in 2011. But chances are, if you know this band, it's because of The Hotel Year's next record, 2014's Home Like No Place Is There, a ragingly uplifting mini-epic that put The Hotel Year in the driver's seat of the so-called emo revival movement. Home was the kind of record that turns fans into fanatics, engendering an intense, intimate connection with a fan base that's poised to explode with the release of The Hotel Year's new record, Goodness. More expansive and dynamic than the band's previous work, Goodness is a sonic bear hug, a call for all lovers of big-hearted rock and roll to gather under the warmth of The Hotel Year's impossibly big tent. Even the indie mainstream is starting to catch on. This summer, The Hotel Year will play the Pitchfork Festival in Chicago, and will surely go down as one of the must-see acts of the weekend. Ahead of all that, however, I managed to get The Hotel Year's frontman, Christian Holden, on the phone right before the band went off for a European tour. We talked about the record as well as the band's history, and I had a really fun time talking with him. So here's our conversation. And thanks again for doing this, by the way. I appreciate it. I know you guys are going on tour in a couple days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We leave on Sunday for Paris, which I'm pretty excited about.
And have you guys played in Europe before?
Yeah, we did a European tour last May. We did a bunch of shows in Germany, and then we did a bunch of shows in the UK with Emperor X.
Now, I mean, this is a cliche interviewer question, but I mean, when you play over in Europe versus playing here in the States, I mean, do you find that it's a different experience?
Sort of, but not really. They're a lot more hospitable. It's definitely a different experience. It's not a much different experience. People are more hospitable. People are more sort of more personable. That's mostly what I got from it. Germany is a lot different. Germany has this whole, I don't know if you've ever heard about this, but Germans have this whole German honesty thing where they basically tell you everything that they think about your band, including if they think you're bad, or if they think certain parts of your band are bad, they'll be like, "Oh, this song is really good. That song, not so much." Or "Your guys' music is really good. Your merch, though, is awful." it's funny in that way, and there's little things like that pop up.
I would think, too, that traveling to Europe right now as an American band might be interesting because, you know, it's a weird time in America right now. You know, it's an election year. Things are so contentious right now. I mean, even the Whopper is angry now. I don't know if you saw that Whopper with the red bun, but even our Whoppers are angry. So, you know, I would think that as an American traveling overseas, that gets projected onto you. I mean, do people ask about America when you're over there?
Not so much. I haven't been since, like, you know, election season started, but I could report back, but I'm not entirely sure. Yeah.
So let's talk about this record that's coming out. Goodness, it's coming out in May. What's the release date?
May 27th.
And yeah. I want to congratulate you, one, because I think the record's awesome. So I think you made a great record. I also want to congratulate you on having an album cover controversy, because I feel like people never care about album covers anymore. And you've actually managed to make people not only care about your cover, but there's some people who are even upset about it. And for those who haven't seen the cover, it's a group of people, like, probably in their 50s and 60s. They're standing there naked. I assume that they're nudists of some kind. Like, where did you get that photo, by the way?
Well, we took it. We put it together and orchestrated the photo shoot and stuff. And so we took it with we took it in Charlton behind my house where I grew up. And sort of got all the models together and did that whole thing, yeah.
Now, I don't want to linger too long on the cover because obviously the music is more important, but, I mean, did you expect people to get upset about it? I mean, it's obviously sort of a provocative cover, but you would think that people would be, you know, used to this or something, but it seems like some people actually got upset. I mean, did that take you by surprise?
I didn't expect people to not really, because, like, I knew it was going to be, like, a sort of polarizing thing, but, like, at the same time, I didn't really expect people to part of it's, like, I haven't seen too many people get really actually upset about it. I've just sort of seen people that are like, oh, I don't really want this album art in my house or something like that, which is a sort of more reasonable way of looking at it, I think. I basically expected everything that ended up coming of it, I think.
I mean, when you listen to the record, the cover certainly fits, I think, thematically with what the record is about. I mean, I know you've described the record as a love record, and just the sound of the songs and what you're talking about lyrically, I mean, it's definitely a very open, sort of empathetic record. And I must imagine that choosing that cover was part of that package, that you wanted to kind of make this record about openness and transparency and in a way being sort of unabashed in your own sort of feelings. I mean, was that sort of the idea with that?
Yeah. I mean, the original idea came a little bit even before the record was done. And I think that I wanted to, because I felt like this record was sort of maybe a little bit of a rising from the ashes from Home Like No Place Is There. I sort of wanted to have an image that evoked sort of newness and youth without and sort of like a more springtime feel. I thought that the using older bodies to do it sort of worked better than if we were to use younger bodies, and Hotelier has sort of always been like a maybe more vulnerable has sort of valued and maybe prioritized vulnerability in all our records, I think that was part of it for sure.
I mean, having older bodies, it's certainly not a sexualized cover. You know, it's not like it's not intended to be erotic or anything on any level. It is more about sort of saying, like, well, this is who we are, and we're presenting ourselves naked or unabashed and unafraid.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is it true, too, that the record's been actually banned? Are you going to be able to sell this on Amazon and record stores? Have you had any problems with that?
We knew that was going to be a thing getting into it, sort of. And it's not necessarily a thing. We just had to make an alternative album art for Amazon and Spotify and Apple and Google and all the sites that are businesses and can't get away with doing what we do because we're they're not just like art platforms we made this I don't necessarily feel like wrongfully censored or like the victim of this thing from Google or whatever. It's just like what it is, and we just had to make an alternative album art, which all we did was put like a square of pixels around the group of bodies, the people in the photo, and in a way it sort of works with the record because the record sort of has like its own little glitchier aspects to it and its own little like abrupt disruptions in the record, and so in that way we thought that it worked also, maybe not in the same way that the original does, but it works also.
I mean, you said before that the reaction that you got was something that you sort of expected to happen, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering, like, looking at this record and where the hotelier is right now in its career, if there's any impulse on your part to, I guess, not run away from success, but to temper it in a way, because I mean, when I listen to Goodness, I think it's a record that is really going to connect with a lot of people. I mean, your previous record had that kind of bond that it formed with an audience, mm-hmm. and I feel like this record, it's not only going to speak to those people, but I could really see it reaching like more people. And you're obviously going to be playing Pitchfork this year, which is a big deal. But I'm wondering if there's like any part of you that's like, yeah, we want to grow our audience, but there's also something great about where we're at right now. Like, we're part of this kind of subculture that is kind of smaller and easier to manage. We have a really, kind of great fan base, and maybe I'm not so sure if I want to pursue that kind of mass market appeal. I mean, is that anything that you've been thinking about at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that from the beginning, even though Hotelier does sort of make it, more accessible than other types of music, because we're generally making pop rock music. There's definitely an aspect of it where we are trying to reach a listener, but we've always sort of had this. We've always sort of not really. We've had an anti-value of not, trying to make a massively appealing record or piece, and that's, and there's certain aspects of it that like kind of maintain that, like mass market media usually won't let stuff that's as wordy as us, it's a harder sell in that way, and we sort of intentionally keep pieces of our work so that it is too complicated to sell in a mass media way, but also it's still working within the framework of pop because that's what we like and that's what we are interested in like playing with this project. So within that context with Goodness, I think that we definitely put certain barriers on our music to prevent it from being something that can have that same mass appeal, because I think in order to do that you sort of have to water what you're doing down, and we sort of just trust our own process and our own abilities, and know that we can make good art without it having to be mass appeal. sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, there's the thing about watering it down. There's also, I imagine, that idea of intimacy, you know, because there does seem to be a relationship that your band has with its audience that is this powerful, almost intimate relationship where people feel like, you know, that their records are part of their lives. And sometimes if things get commodified too much, it can dilute that a bit, I'm sure. I mean, what made me ask that question before is that, like, you wrote this blog post. I think it was maybe before the album was announced. But it was earlier this year, and you were talking about this idea of performance versus transparency, you know, and trying to kind of reconcile that when you're in a band. That on one hand, you want to express something genuine, and you want your audience to feel something when you put out your music, but you're also in a band that tours, and you have to play these songs every night, and there's certainly an aspect of recreation that goes on. Even, I guess you could say, it's contrivance, maybe, you know, performing things like this every night, because you're not going to feel it necessarily every night when you're on the road. I'm just wondering, like, what prompted you to write that? I mean, because I feel like a lot of artists wrestle with that, and yet they don't always articulate it. I mean, what kind of prompted you to address that publicly, and is that something that you're still thinking about a lot?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, the purpose of the post was to say that, I mean, yes, the hotelier does have, like, a very intimate connection with the fans, and in a lot of ways, the hotelier is always sort of interacting with, like, the natural and the genuine and, you know, the real to an extent, like, you know, real feelings and stuff. And that's something I've just been lucky enough to have in my life is a bunch of artists from all different mediums and backgrounds and you know, levels of education and such. And so I've had to, like, and we've been, you know, lucky enough that people are making art are also interested in the work that we're doing. I've got to have a lot of, like, sort of just interesting conversations with different artists, like, from, again, different backgrounds. And this conversation comes up when it's like, when I'm seeing people who are making art where the performance is much more talked about, and you know, the aesthetic is much more talked about, and intentional, and sort of like and not something that is necessarily interacting with the real as much, and is more consumed with fantasy, and that sort of and watching their performances and seeing them interact with fantasy more can, like, and still have that evoke, you know, certain feelings within me, sort of makes me think that, you know, that you can, that interacting with fantasy and interacting with realness is the same thing. And then when I see these performances by people who are trying to interact with realness and it's not moving me, I sort of feel like, okay, where's the failure as an artist, who is interacting with realness, but can't evoke these certain feelings within me. And I think that it, you know, maybe it comes from me being a music performer who's interacting with realness and thinking about just how often it's not talked about, how performance is not talked about because it's supposed to be something that is, like, you know, so pure and so, you know, that it doesn't have a language for it. Which I think in a lot of ways, you know, art has that, but, like, I think that it's not, I just had this feeling that, you know, sometimes art isn't as, even, you know, even me on stage performing these songs every night, you know, when I write them, they are, you know, maybe from a place of realness and also maybe from a place of fantasy, and then I'm performing them. So I do feel like a performer. I feel like if I'm a performer, then all these other musicians that are, you know, our contemporaries must also be performers in some regard. So I was just thinking about that a lot, just like how we are performers and how, you know, just how we relate to our audience, especially within rock music, where it just seems like it's mostly about being real. It just seems like a failure to not address performance within performing realness or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I always feel like rock and roll at its best, and really you could say art at its best, but for me it's mm-hmm. like reality exaggerated, where like mm-hmm. you're taking something that does resonate, like you know, in people's lives that matter, and you sort of elevate it in a way that almost turns it into a metaphor, I think, for people's emotions. Like if you listen to like your records, I feel like people listen to your records because they're trying to reconcile things in their own lives and maybe work through things in their life, and it's something that they can relate to, and then they can get catharsis from it. You know, but like the only, like to me, the only like reality that matters is like if you put on a record and you like feel something in your chest, and that's how you know it's real. And like, you know, when you watch and you get that when you watch a movie, like if there's a great actor giving a performance, I mean, they you know, that is explicitly giving a performance. But like what makes it real is their is that actor's ability to communicate something to the viewer that they can feel in their own heart. And I think that's where the reality comes in. I think that's the only thing that matters ultimately. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what makes art so great, is that it's something that like it takes the material real life and it elevates it to something else that is beautiful or sad or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, agreed, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think that and sometimes, you know, not all art has to necessarily be that. Sometimes art is, you know, or like music is a hobby, and I think that's more of a thing that I've noticed with within punk, is sometimes it's not about, you know, performance, and sometimes it's about, you know, just having fun and playing these songs that you've written for your friends. But in a lot of cases it still incorporates performance in the same way that you were just talking about with like actors and again across most mediums of art.
So
or at least performance art.
So let's talk a little bit about the band's history. Like you formed in high school, right?
Mm-hmm. I was a junior, Chris and Sam were seniors, and Zach was a freshman when we all started.
And like, had you been in any bands before that?
I mean, I had written a bunch of songs for this like sort of you know, pre-hotelier sort of pop rock thingy when I was a freshman in high school. Chris and Sam had played in various like kind of punkin' screamo bands, and Zach had also just been writing a lot of pop stuff, and me and Zach sort of lived right down the road from each other, so we were always talking about you know, playing together. So this is the first time that we got to do that was with Hotelier. And then me and Chris have been playing in this sort of like screamo-y, you know, heavy band. And Sam was just our friend who had also played in other bands. So, so we had all played in bands prior of different genres and also similar genres. This is sort of just an extension of the stuff I was doing my freshman year. And when we started it.
And like, were you always a punk rock guy, or did you have like something that you were into before and then you transitioned?
I don't know if I was, I was always into music that was semi influenced by punk rock. I don't know if I was ever like a punk rock guy. I think Chris was one of the people that got me into more or different artists and punk rock, and a lot of them still stand out to me. Like I was really into Latterman, and I was really into Oscar, and I was really into Kid Dynamite for like punk rock stuff. But like for the most part, I was, you know, the bands that I was listening to growing up were, I guess, like pop punk stuff. Like I was just like when I was young, I was into Blink-182. And when I learned about, you know, different ways on the internet to listen to music, I just sort of dived in and found a bunch of stuff that I really liked. And most of it was like more poppy, emotional rock stuff. That was like coming out like maybe, mid 2000s, or early 2000s. That's sort of where I got most of my chops in writing was mostly from just like browsing MySpace music, for the most part. Yeah.
Now, I mean, like the tag that your band often gets saddled with, and I don't know what your feelings are about this, but you know, you've been sort of associated with like the emo revivalism thing. Mm-hmm. And there was this idea, like in the media, that you know that there was a period where, like, where emo and pop punk wasn't fashionable, and now it's sort of come back and is big again. I mean, like when you were first starting to listen to music and you're listening to these bands, I mean, did you have the sense that these bands weren't cool, or like were you just like, well, this is just what I like, and you didn't even like really care about that kind of stuff?
I've talked to other musicians. A lot of musicians that I've met had their roots in like Blink-182 or Green Day or something to that effect. And then at some point somebody tells them that that's not cool to like anymore. And that's sort of where they divert to different styles of music. I think, at least in my experience, that's what I've noticed. I think that there was some understanding that what I was listening to maybe wasn't the coolest stuff, but I was just into it. And like, I thought that the songwriting was really cool. I don't know. I don't know if there was probably a period where I thought that stuff wasn't cool. And then I sort of revisit it from time to time and like can appreciate it for what it is. But I don't know. Yeah.
Like when you first started playing music, was the idea to just like cover songs you already loved, or were you already thinking in terms of like writing your own songs?
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, like when I first started playing, yeah, we were covering songs. That was when I was in like sixth grade or something. And then I think by eighth grade, I was I didn't really like covering songs. I just wanted to like write my own stuff. I was never really like that into covers. I was always into trying to like flesh out my own ideas for songs and stuff.
And why do you think that is?
Because
a lot of people never make that leap. You know, they're just like, "Well, I love Blink-182, so I'm going to play." You know, Damn It, and that's I'm satisfied with that. You know, I mean, where do you think that impulse came from to actually become a songwriter?
I think that I just like wanted to perform for people, and I probably had some sort of like, you know, dream of like being able to play with other people, and I thought that, you know, covering songs wasn't going to be the way to do that, maybe. And there was also just like, you know, for as long as, you know, when I was a kid, I was singing a lot of songs to myself, but I was also like just making up sort of like random songs in my head all the time. So I think there's just this like innate thing within me that wants, that just does write songs instead of repeat songs in my head. I'm always sort of just like coming up with like the things that are stuck in my head usually aren't songs that are already made. They're usually just things that I'm just, that are just nothing things that I just come up with and just repeat in my head all day or something. So I think that just within me, I am a songwriter. I have like the aptitude for songwriting more so than maybe other people that just are content and happy doing covers and stuff. Maybe that, I think.
I mean, what did you have this idea that you were going to use music like to bare your soul to people? Like, was that something like some idea that you had? Like, I'm going to, you know, write about my own life or confess, make this a confessional. Like, was that part of your thinking at all when you started doing that?
No, not really. I think I remember the first song that I ever wrote. I've always written in the sort of same way where I write. I really am into melody and I'm really into beat, and I usually will write some melodies and beats, and then like I remember the first song I ever wrote, I had to like sit down and write lyrics, and I had no idea what to write about. I was just like, this song needs lyrics. I have a vocal melody for it, so I need to put some lyrics down. And I think there was like I think I just had set a standard for myself for you know, maybe how I would write lyrics, but like I didn't want to write too straightforward. Like I did want to be a little bit more poetic with it, I think, with my very first song that I ever wrote. And but it was just literally a song about how I think I wrote a song about how I had no inspiration to write anything. And that was what the first song I ever wrote was about. So I don't know if I ever like desired to bare my soul so much. It just sort of was stylistically what I fell into, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel, I mean, because that is something that people have latched on to you about your band, and that seems to continue on the new record, Goodness. I mean, I think of that song, Opening Mail for My Grandmother, which is this sort of gut-wrenching song on the record. And there is this idea, I think, as a listener, that like, wow, I'm listening to this guy talk about people that he knows or you know, or tragedies in his own life, and this is an intense thing. I mean, is it straight autobiography for you, or is there sort of other elements that come into play with your songwriting?
I mean, I would say that for the most part, like with our old stuff, with our older stuff, it was like, I'll just start with Goodness. With Goodness, it's not, as autobiographical as like Home, is, for the most part. I mean, like Housebroken's not an autobiographical song, but, for the most part that record is. And this one I sort of, Opening Mail is a song that I had written like for my grandmother while I was, you know, seeing her from time to time. But most of the songs on that record are, you know, in a way creative nonfiction. You know, I'm taking either life experiences or, just stories from my life, and then sort of, thinking about them in ways that sort of make more sense than reality does, and then writing them down like that. I think Two Deliverances is an example of that. And then, some songs are just like, again, straight storytelling. Like I have an idea in my brain or an idea that like feels constant in my life, and I need to explain it in a way that reality just can't do. So Sun or Soft Animal, for example, are songs in which I'm trying to relay an idea that I can't necessarily explain just straight through straightforward talking or straight reality. I think I messed around with storytelling a little bit more on this record than I have in the past.
And I mean, how deliberate was that on your part? I mean, did you kind of go into it thinking that that's how you wanted to write, or did it just turn out that way?
Both. With Home was an album written when there was like a whole lot of like living going on. You know, I was living at home, and I wasn't touring as much as I, you know, have been in the past 2 years. And there was a whole lot of like stories with people and situations with people that I had to write about. It's not like I've stopped living since I've been touring so much, but you know, the same is not true where I was, you know, involved in many different, personal relationships that were sort of deep and involved. That doesn't sort of have the same situation now when I'm gone so much. My life goes on, and I still am a living person with developing state or whatever. So I knew that I had to. I didn't have as much to write about that was concrete, and it was all more abstract things that I was, you know, wanting to portray. And thus I knew I had to start writing more songs that were more storytelling or whatever, or like abstract maybe.
I mean, your band has had sort of it seems like it's unique now in terms of your trajectory, because you know, you put out your first record in 2011, and you know, that record is called It Never Goes Out. And then, you know, and that was pretty well received, and I think like emo circles, but like not, it didn't have a huge impact, and then your second record comes out, and that does have a pretty big impact. So you've had this sort of like gradual rise, and now, you know, you put out this record, and I'm always fascinated when bands record a record knowing that there's going to be an audience out there like waiting for it, and also mm-hmm. knowing that the media is going to be talking about it and stuff. Like, did that in any way impact you as you were making this record, or were you consciously kind of trying to block out a lot of that noise, you know, as you were putting this together?
Yeah, no, that's actually something that I'm pretty interested in as well. That's something that I had noticed even before we put out Home, was like, I was interested in seeing how bands who, there's like this sort of, something that I've noticed is there's a sort of barrier where there's artists that put out earlier records in a way to sort of validate their work, or in a way to like earn validation for their work. Until they do that, they sort of, stay with a sort of formula or mess around in a particular way until, you know, something sticks. And then when they sort of put out a record that is received and validated, then they have to, the next record is responding to the following record, you know?
Right.
So I've noticed that with like a lot of bands is, sometimes they'll put out a follow-up record that seems like, sort of a reactionary sort of, I'm trying to think of the words to say. They put out a record that's sort of like more in your face and challenging for the listener, I guess.
Yeah.
Or are just purposefully messing with the listener.
Right.
And part of me while I was starting was like, I think that's like, you know, I think that's just like not that cool. Like, I think that like you should appreciate the people that like your music and maybe not. But then as I started writing this record and I was thinking about like, you know, we're making a record that responds to Home in a way. You do want to challenge your listener. You want to present yourself how, you basically have control of how your audience is going to view you from then on out, and you want to affirm your identity basically as a band and as an individual and as an artist and all that stuff. And I think that was a thing that I was thinking about a lot through this record. I didn't really block it out because in for me it was fun. It was like,
yeah.
Now I get to, you know, now we have this sort of validation. Now I don't have to worry about like how the record is going to proceed because I know that I sort of believe in our abilities again, and I trust our fans to like understand what we're doing because I do feel able to present ideas accurately through music and through words, and so I just had fun with the process of, developing what the hotelier is with goodness. And, yeah, it wasn't really that much pressure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that phenomenon that you were referencing earlier, that, you know, the idea of, like, the band putting out, like, a successful record, and then they're going to put out, like, the abrasive record after that. And, like, you know, that's, like, In Utero is probably the most obvious example of that phenomenon. And then there are bands who go in the opposite direction where they have, like, a big record, and then maybe they go in a quieter direction. And I guess, like, Automatic for the People or something, like, that REM record would be an example of that. And in a way, I feel like you've sort of gone in the latter direction. I mean, I think this is still, like, a very sort of anthemic rock record, but there are quieter moments on this record. You know, there's like interludes on the record that are, you know, it's like acoustic, and or there's like spoken word stuff, and there's like songs that don't have drums on them, or, you know, that maybe stay at, you know, sort of a like a quieter dynamic. I mean, it does seem that this record there is maybe a wider range of emotion mm-hmm. than there was on the last record, or at least a wider range of sounds and dynamics. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you say that's fair? A fair assessment?
Yeah. 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 I mean, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great record, and I think people are really going to dig it. And it's been really great talking with you, Christian, and best of luck with everything moving forward. Have fun in Europe.
Cool. Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you, too.
All right, man. Take care. All right. That was Christian from The Hotelier. And yeah, man, Goodness is such a great record. I am really excited for the rest of the world to hear it. I really think it's going to be one of the breakout rock records of the year. Now, let's talk about my other favorite band of the moment, Car Seat Headrest. This project is the brainchild of Will Toledo, a 23-year-old wunderkind who has been writing songs, recording albums, and distributing music via Bandcamp since his high school years. While he wasn't born until the early 90s, Toledo's music is rooted in the indie rock of that time, particularly bands like Pavement and Guided by Voices. But what really sets Toledo apart is his ability to constantly churn out catchy melodies that belie a deep-seated, though often darkly comic, melancholy. Toledo's songs tend to grab you immediately, and then they linger in your guts once the buzz wears off. So how does he do this, and why is Teens of Denial such a great record? Well, I talked to Will Toledo about all these things, and here's our conversation. Well, Will, thanks again for giving me some time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
been a busy morning.
Yeah, you're in Seattle, right?
Yeah, I am.
And did you move there recently, right? You're not originally from Seattle, are you?
No, I moved from Virginia about 2 years ago.
And why Seattle?
People keep asking me that. I don't know. There wasn't a great reason to come here other than I knew a few people and knew that it was a good music scene. And I had graduated college, so I had nothing to do in Virginia.
Right.
So I decided to come here and try my luck.
And what do you think of Seattle so far?
I like it. You know, you can basically put me most places and, I'll be okay with it as long as it's not super cold.
Right.
You know, it's mostly the me about the people, and I've been able to find good people here and get a good band going, which is the important thing.
I mean, there's, you know, when people talk about bands from Seattle or just the Northwest in general, you know, people inevitably talk about the climate there, about how it's overcast and rainy a lot, and how that ends up being sort of inspirational.
People do talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's always about like how inspirational it ends up being for the bands because they can't go outside, so they're inside writing songs or playing instruments. I mean, has that been your experience living there?
No, I haven't really noticed it. I mean, Virginia is pretty rainy, too, especially Williamsburg, where I went to college. It's kind of the same thing here. Honestly, it seems to rain a little less here in the time that I've been here, although I think it's been a sunny year or two since I've come here relatively. But, yeah, I mean, right now, the inspiration I'm drawing is still mainly residue from Virginia. I don't know at what point I'm going to start being inspired by Seattle, but it won't show up for a bit, I think.
Is there any ways that you would pinpoint as far as like how Virginia, where you came from, like how that informed like what you do musically?
Well, I don't think my hometown Leesburg did much shaping of anything. I do think that Williamsburg, being there for 4 years, was a little bit more formative. Just, you know, both the people I met there in college and the town itself, which is this sort of weird hybrid between the college town and a colonial tourist attraction, basically. Because especially my last year when I was living outside campus, I was coming through the colonial section to get to college. So it was this weird blend of cultures, and there's not a lot of local culture beyond that, I think. So it was just sort of, you know, the very young liberal arts campus crew, and then this ancient history thing that was coming into collision in my life.
Does also being in an area where, you know, I'm sure there were bands there, but it's not as overwhelming as it is being maybe in a bigger city like, you know, New York or LA or something? I mean, do you feel like that, in a way, having that kind of space, did that help you at all, you think, creatively?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I tended towards it because it was this sleepy little town. I'd come there after a semester at VCU, which is in Richmond, and that was a much more urban environment, and I didn't like it so much, so I came out to William & Mary to sort of, you know, have a quieter college experience, I guess.
Right.
And just, yeah, the sort of people who are drawn there, I think I felt an affinity for a lot of the other students there. And, yeah, it was a very small music scene there. And so everyone, you know, was kind of piled on top of each other as far as band lineups went. There were, you know, there were a dozen people who were in all the bands, basically. And, yeah, that definitely led to a higher, you know, level of interaction between a few people, I think, whereas in a city it would be about a little bit of interaction with a lot of people.
Right.
But yeah, there are just sort of like a few key artists who I worked a lot with. And actually, Seth, our bassist now, is a holdover from William & Mary days because we met in college.
Okay. Now, I know that you've been, you know, making recordings for a long time and writing songs, like, for a relatively long time anyway. I mean, you're not that old yet, so you haven't been doing anything for a long time necessarily. But
right.
But as far as, like, performing, like, have you been performing for a while? Have you been recording and now you're kind of performing now because people know your music?
Yeah, kind of. I knew that when I left college I'd be performing more, so that was my first goal in leaving, is to form a more permanent lineup and start performing more. For a long time it was just the recording aspect of it that interested me. I never thought of myself as a great performer. I was more interested in songwriting and arranging, in the recording software, the songs, and then the album was kind of the ultimate art form for me.
Right.
But in recent years, I came to appreciate, you know, what live performance could do that you couldn't do in recording, and started to work with those elements more. And so it was just kind of fortuitous timing that, as soon as I started to focus, I started to focus on live performance a little bit before, you know, all this other stuff came along. So I kind of had a bit of practice by the time people started paying attention to us.
Right.
And we'd been playing, the basic lineup had been playing for about a year by the time we went on our first tour, first big tour.
And, you know, later this year, you're going to be playing some pretty big shows, like you're going to be at Pitchfork this summer and stuff like that. I mean, how do you feel as a live performer at this point? Do you feel like you're pretty good at it? Are you enjoying it? Or is there still like a learning curve with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a continuous curve just because, you know, the shows are continuing to get bigger, and it's definitely a different experience playing in a small basement and playing on a festival stage. And so I think we've gotten good at the basement part of it, and now we've got to start practicing on the bigger stages.
Right.
So that can be a little intimidating, but I think, yeah, we've, at this point, it feels like we've had a lot of practice as a band, and we're pretty tight at a core selection of songs, at least. And I think we've got what we need to continue at this point, and I'm happy with the shows that we're doing right now.
I mean, I assume by the time you get to Pitchfork, there's going to be like a laser light show, and you're going to be like spitting out blood and stuff like that, right?
That's the one thing we're lagging on. We really don't have any crew at the moment. It's just been the band, and our booking agent just keeps, you should really get a tour manager and a sound guy for the next tour. And it's like, well, maybe.
What?
And
it's like, if this next record does really well, you can hire a guy just to make the fake blood that you need.
Right, yeah.
You know, you can have that one.
It is still a question of money. It's just a weird kind of disparity because, we got signed to a relatively big label, and they have, you know, they have certain expectations from artists, but in a more realistic sense, we're not that big of a band as far as the money is concerned. So we're right. Trying to keep stuff to more to our level, which is basically band only at this point, and right. probably by the end of the year, you know, a couple crew members. But yeah, it's I don't want to go too big on the crew aspect at the moment because you know, it's easy to get carried away when everyone around you is used to working with bands that work on a much bigger level.
Right. Absolutely. Now, we're talking in late March, and the your upcoming record, Teens of Denial, it was just announced today. And
That's right. So
people are starting to talk about it. I've been lucky enough. I got an early advance of the record, so I've been listening to it for like a month or two, and I really love it. I think it's one of the best records I've heard this year.
Sweet.
So it's awesome. I'm just wondering, you know, and this has been talked a lot about in other stories about you, but you know, you already have like a pretty sizable collection of records that you put out on Bandcamp. You had like 11 records on Bandcamp before you put out your first record on Matador, which was Teens of Style, which came out last year, and which was sort of a greatest hits in a way from those Bandcamp releases. You took songs and re-recorded them for that record. And this is sort of like a full-fledged, like new, this Teens of Denial record that's coming out. It's like a full-fledged kind of solo record coming out on Matador. But, you know, after working in the Bandcamp realm for a couple years, you know, now you're working with Matador and there's this promotional sort of build-up to each release as opposed to you just recording something and posting it on the internet. I mean, has that been an adjustment for you not to have that instant gratification of recording something and then putting it out immediately?
Kind of, but it was something I was already sort of transitioning out of. I mean, when I first started, I'd put up the album, you know, straight away. Sometimes I'd upload the songs, you know, song by song, instead of waiting for the full album to even be recorded. I'd just post it as I went along. And then I started saving it and for a full album release, and then I started, you know, holding off and establishing actual release dates for the album. So, you know, I was basically ready for a full-scale album cycle where the album was recorded, and then we actually waited a bit before the release. But, you know, there's still some elements, there's still an element of surprise to it. It's funny, when it came out today, there was an error on the Bandcamp page where you could actually download it if you purchased the album. You could get the full album. Yeah, for like an hour this morning. So about 20 people, 20 lucky fans got an early copy of the album. But, you know, I kind of like that stuff. When an album release is rough around the edges, because I don't know, I like seeing that as a fan, and it kind of is a fun thing when the album comes out a little earlier than intended. But yeah, I mean, I think it's always going to be a little strange having the music and having certain people have the music and then having to wait for the public release. But yeah,
I mean, do you keep pretty close tabs on like what people say about your music? Like, do you read stories? Are you on social media, or do you try to block that stuff out?
I pretty much check it out. I'm a social media guy. I'm an internet guy, so I can't really help but look at what people are saying. But you know, I try and keep it in context and understand who's saying what. You know, people who don't like it versus people who are way into it, and you know, how many people are actually checking out the music on a deep level versus just surface level judgment of it. And you know, I try and only take it to heart if it, you know, if those people seem like they have really checked it out and explored it. And, you know, those responses can be really helpful. And I try and sort through all the chat to find the meaningful responses.
Right. You know, I'm fascinated by your backstory a bit. Now, are you 23 now?
Yeah.
You're 23. And when did you first start recording songs? Like when you were, it was like 18 or so, right?
Well, that's when I started Crazy Headdress. Really, I was recording songs, you know, growing up just on the family computer. And I got a laptop when I was 16 or 17, and that's when I really started recording full songs. And I actually recorded a couple albums before Crazy Headdress, just on my own.
And what was the name of that project?
I called it Nervous Young Men at the time, and it had a Bandcamp page of its own, which is now gone.
And isn't it true, too, that you got started, and this is where the band name comes from, that you were recording songs in your parents' car?
Yeah, that's I was recording vocals in there, at least.
And why did you do that?
For the sake of privacy. I was living with my family at the time, and you know, there's home recording, there's not a lot of good recording spaces, basically, where you have the space to do what you need. So I went out to the car to do it.
And are you still recording at home? Like, was Teens of Denial done, like, at your home studio?
No, Teens of Denial was in a couple Seattle studios in Ballard. We had our producer, Steve Fisk, pick out a couple good ones for us.
And what was that like, moving from, you know, recording on your own to working like in a professional studio? Was that strange, making that transition?
No, I mean, that was another thing where I'd wanted to do it for a while. I was used to studio spaces. In college, we had a recording studio in our radio station, and I didn't actually use the equipment there. I would just go in and record on my own with my own equipment. But, you know, I was used to the basic layout of it. And then when we went in and actually, you know, had a professional working with us in a professional setup, it was really easy, you know, because they make it easy for the band to just kind of go in and play the songs. So, you know, it was, yeah, I wasn't expecting it to be that much of a simple transition, but really it was. And the mixing of the album was a little more difficult just because I'm used to doing most of the work and arranging and creating the songs on the computer. And this time it was more, you know, what we did in the studio is what you hear on the album. So that took some getting used to. But I think by the end of it, we'd sort of gotten into a good system.
You know, like bands in the past that are known for, you know, lo-fi recording or home recording, you know, whether it's like Pavement or Guided by Voices, I guess would be the two most obvious examples. You know, there's sort of a romantic idea tied up in that, where you're capturing something more honest or raw if you're not working in a traditional studio. Mm-hmm. Did you have any of that feeling when you were home recording, or was it really just out of necessity? Like, would you have recorded in a real studio if you had the opportunity when you were 16?
Well, I think it was both. And I remember when I was doing the album Twin Fantasy, I was just thinking of it as demos at the time. And I thought I wanted to go and record it in a real studio after I was done, but I ended up just releasing it as it was. But you know, I would agree that there's something to the idea of it being more immediate as a demo. And you know, and earlier on in my career, I definitely valued that, but I think I've come to appreciate the other side of it, which is that, you know, there's no way to be completely immediate as far as music is concerned. You know, there's always some delay between the idea and when it gets passed on to the audience. And sometimes it's better to forgo immediacy in order to craft something that is really special and really communicates what you're trying to say on a better level than if you're just putting it out there as fast as possible. Definitely when I started Car Seat Headdress, the goal was to just get stuff out of me and onto the computer as fast as possible. And, you know, doing that versus crafting stuff out more and trying to polish it, I definitely liked the polished stuff better and thought that it communicated what I meant more clearly than the original impulse. And so I've been tending that way for a while now.
From listening to Teens of Denial, it seems like you are conscious of trying to strike a balance in a way, because it does sound bigger than your previous records, but it's not really overtly slick in a way that I would think of, like that Guided by Voices record, Do the Collapse. So it was like when they went with Rick Ocasek, you know, that was obviously sort of like a radio-friendly record that sounded a lot different from their other stuff. Whereas with this record, you haven't gone that far. It just seems bigger. I mean, I must imagine that that was something you were trying to be conscious of to retain the feel that those other that your older records had, but just kind of do it in a bigger way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in choosing Steve Fisk, yeah, he's someone who I picked because I liked the sounds he was making. I liked the bands he was working with. He didn't necessarily have, I mean, I think he could, what I liked about his repertoire is that he could kind of do it both. He could make something that sounded a little more radio friendly, but he wasn't afraid of working with more lo-fi elements. And I think that's ultimately what colored this, because I wasn't super opposed to it being a more slick album, because that's kind of, you know, that's what it's meant to be, is a step towards shininess in comparison to my older stuff. But it was more about, you know, in the moment, does this sound good or does this sound bad? And I guess just more typically when there was slick stuff in the mix, I thought it sounded bad, so I didn't want to work with it. So we ended up with an album that was, cleaner, but still fairly untouched as far as studio polish was concerned.
Now, you mentioned Steve Fisk. Just to give people some context, some of the other bands that he's worked with include Nirvana, like he did the Blue Sessions with Nirvana. He's worked with The Wedding Present, Mudhoney. He worked with the Posies, a lot of like kind of big 90s bands. And, in 90s rock is brought up a lot when people talk about your music as a reference point. I mean, do you feel like that's been overstated, or do you feel like that is kind of where your roots are as far as like the records that you're making?
Yeah, well, I think that this album's roots in particular are definitely have their roots in the 90s. Specifically Nirvana and Green Day, two bands I listened to a lot in middle school and high school. I think I was pulling from those influences a lot when I was writing this album. And I even went back and used some material that I had written at that time for this album, just some chord progressions and stuff. But it was definitely supposed to be a callback to not necessarily the 90s, but the period in my life where I was checking that music out. And also when we were recording, I was getting a lot more exposure to some of the bands that Steve had produced, because some of them I hadn't really ever listened to before, like Unwound. And then just hanging out with him, spending time, I got a decent amount of exposure to both that 90s music and then more current local Seattle music that's sort of in the same tradition. So it was sort of this whole cultural thing that was unfolding as we recorded the album that it ended up having a bit of the flavor of, I think.
And I was going to say, just from talking with you and reading other interviews that you've done, I mean, it seems like you have a pretty extensive knowledge of rock history already. And, you know, and that also is apparent just from listening to your records. I mean, one of my favorite songs on Teens of Denial is a song called "There's a Policeman in All Our Heads, He Must Be Destroyed," which quotes "The Car Is Just What I Needed," which you quote it musically at the beginning, and then you do a callback to some of the lyrics at the end of the song. When did that education begin for you? I mean, were you a music nerd pretty early on?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say music nerd, because it was very specific, the bands that I liked. I was kind of against exploring extensively rock. Well, I'm maybe not against it, but it was harder in the sort of pre-Spotify age to explore a whole genre. You kind of had to be introduced by individual albums and artists. But very early on, I was listening to The Who and The Beatles. Some of the first Christmas gifts I remember asking for The Who Sell Out and A Quick One. I think I might have gotten those the same year. Oh, and Yellow Submarine, the soundtrack version, or the CD version with all the hits on it.
Hey Bulldog. Hey Bulldog is the big one on that one.
But, yeah, I mean, it was just specific bands, you know, the Beatles, The Who, the Beach Boys to a slightly lesser extent, and then Pink Floyd later on was a big one, REM. But just, and I think these were big bands, and I think those were all also bands that represented big chunks of rock history and were pulling from a lot of different sources. So I think I kind of got a sort of streamlined approach to rock history where I was listening to these bands that, that, you know, you could draw branches off of into, you know, 100 different bands that preceded them or were working contemporaneously. And I'm just really starting to explore all the other acts around them that they were drawing from. But, yeah, that's kind of how it started. And I still would consider myself a student, basically, of rock.
Like, what are you into now?
I guess I've moved away from mainstream rock. Well, maybe I wouldn't say that. I don't know. The past day and a half, I've been listening basically nonstop to Do What You Gotta Do by Nina Simone, which was actually because of the Kanye sample, or the sample that Kanye used of it on his new album.
Oh, right.
But, yeah, just stuff that is kind of the roots of rock and roll. I've been checking out more of James Brown in the past couple of years. I've been very big on, and I don't know, just weirder and smaller acts have been of more interest to me than the super big rock acts that I sort of started out with. You know, I think, that's the usual trend of academia, is that you start out with the big things and then drift into obscurity.
Definitely. You know, I've read other interviews that you've done, and you've talked about how when you were growing up, you felt isolated a bit, like from other, you know, people at school or whatever. And I'm wondering, you know, do you think that had anything to do with the fact that you were listening to like a lot of this older music that maybe other people your age weren't into, or is it the reverse, and were you drawn to that kind of stuff because you already felt isolated?
Yeah, I mean, I think both were just sort of a personality thing. You know, I didn't engage much with modern culture, and that both meant socialization and the music aspect of it, where I wasn't really listening to what other people were listening to. In high school, though, I connected plenty with people through music because of the indie scene, you know, trading back and forth, Neutromilk Hotel and Radiohead. Well, Radiohead's not indie, but
right.
I guess for millennials, they're a bit more indie. But yeah, I mean, the old school rock phase was at a very early age, and then as I grew up, I gradually started checking out more modern stuff, and eventually, you know, reach contemporary times, although I still mainly listen to older stuff. But, yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a decent community built around discussing music in general, as far as the indie scene is concerned. And, you can find people who care about the older stuff and aren't just, checking out what's popular at the moment.
Right. You know, a lot of your, early songs are about, you know, being in high school or being a teenager, which makes sense because that's when you were writing those songs. And the titles of your last two records sort of reflect that point of view. But then, you know, I was just thinking about the video that you made that came out for the song Vincent, which was, I guess, the first single off of Teens of Denial. And that video seemed very indicative of like an early 20-something lifestyle, or at least it reminded me of being that age, because it's basically about this guy who's sort of miserable and getting drunk a lot and going to parties and yeah, being intoxicated but not really being happy. And I was like, that reminds me of being 22. You know,
right,
that's exactly
yeah.
my experience. I mean, do you feel like that that where you are in your life right now, are you writing about that yet, or are you still processing it, and is that going to show up in your songs maybe in a couple years?
I guess, you know, as far as right now is concerned, I am still in the process of processing, and it won't show up for a while. But I do also think that, it's the music that's coming out now is not very far off from where I was. I mean, the line between 22 or 23 and 19 and 20 is, not very distinct. And I think a lot of 19 and 20-year-olds feel the same sort of way as is reflected in the video, which the video was sort of the idea was collaborative between me and Quinn, the director, who I don't know how old he is, but he's a bit older than me. So it might, it might reflect that as well. But, there's no clear period when, the teenage years stop and maturity begins. It's just a mental process, really. And I think I am on my way with that mental process. Hopefully the next album or so will reflect that. But for now, might as well celebrate being young, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that, like, you, as you were saying, that, like, 19 to 20 isn't that much of a gap. But, like, I mean, that post-college life, that's definitely a big transition, and that's what you're in right mm-hmm. now. So that I'm sure will provide you lots of fodder for songs, in the upcoming years ahead. Well, Will, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been great, and I love the new record. I love the old records, and best of luck with everything.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for talking.
All right. That was Will Toledo of Car Seat Headrest. Again, Teens of Denial, a great, great record that comes out in May. You should definitely look out for it. And in the meantime, definitely go on Bandcamp and check out all of Toledo's other records. There's definitely a lot to dive into, so enjoy that. Guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Celebration Rock. And remember, this is your podcast too, so help us spread the word. Tell your friends about us. Talk about us on social media. And, leave us a rating or even a review on iTunes. Just a minute of your time to help us spread the word. It makes all the difference in the world. Again, I want to thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we will see you again next week.